I'm Robin Farmer, your host for this edition of the Writer's Voice for Virginia Voice, and I want to extend a warm homecoming welcome to Josephine Ensign, whose memoir, Catching Homelessness, A Nurse's Story of Falling Through the Safety Net, was published in August by She Writes Press. Josephine grew up in Hanover County, later lived and worked in Richmond before relocating to Seattle, where she has lived since 1994. She's an associate professor at the University of Washington, where she teaches community health, health policy, and narrative medicine, which we'll talk about later. A graduate of Oberlin College and Johns Hopkins University, she has been a nurse for over 30 years, providing health care for homeless and marginalized people. The last time I saw you, we were both attending the James River Writers Conference.
We sure were, and we were sitting outside in the lovely fall Richmond sunshine and having lunch and talking about the past and the present and what you're writing as well.
Exactly. We were talking about our writing projects. And so I'm so delighted to have your book in my hand. But I also have to share that I'm inspired because you actually crossed the finish line and you finished your work and I'm still working on mine. So I'm hoping the next time we see each other, I have a book
okay.
to give you.
I'll ask you about it then, Robin.
Let me start off by reading one of your lovely reviews, which captures the essence of Catching Homelessness. Catching Homelessness is a powerful and personal story of providing nursing care for the homeless in Richmond and of the author's own experience of homelessness when her life and values no longer fit the expectations for a good white Southern Christian wife and mother. Ensign loses her home in every respect. Homelessness is both very real and very near. It is a metaphor for ills that could befall any of us. In the era of foreclosures and income inequality, catching homelessness is a risk we share. Ensign never preaches, but draws the reader into the world of people pushed to the margins. And to those few, like Ensign herself, who feel drawn to our common humanity. That is just so lovely. As a child, you wrote about dreaming of becoming a missionary doctor or a scientist. So please share with us what led you to open the Crossover Clinic at the Richmond Street Center in 1986, where in the first year you encountered over 1,600 patients.
That's a good question. Of course, it has a long, long, long answer, which I will abbreviate here. I was born and raised on a Christian camp, and my father is a Presbyterian minister, so I was raised with those values. My father and Camp Hanover still is very much about having children come to a safe space outside in God's world, in the environment, and learning to get along with each other, working out conflicts in a civil way, which, of course, we need more of, don't we? And also our responsibility for each other and for the environment. And that's really the roots of what I was drawn to in terms of work. I obviously didn't start Crossover. The ministry was started by the Reverend Buddy Childress and some physicians like Dr. Cullen Rivers. But I was the first employee. I knew that that's the kind of work I wanted to do. So in that way, I started that part of the clinic at Crossover at the Richmond Street Center.
Catching Homelessness talks about the numerous experiences you had that made you a better nurse practitioner. You worked with challenging patients dealing with mental health issues, substance abuse. It was the beginning of the crack epidemic, HIV, AIDS, trauma from childhood abuse. All of these experiences with individuals with an array of needs made you a pioneer in understanding the direct link between homelessness and health. Can you expand on that?
Something that comes to mind, I currently teach nursing students, medical students, interprofessional students, and a very big emphasis for me is cultural humility. being able to be self-aware enough of what's coming up, that we feel that somebody else is different from us, that we're judging them, that they're less than us for whatever reason. A nurse that I work with, a Maori nurse in New Zealand, so she's native New Zealander, who talks about this, admonishes students to be uncomfortable, that that's how you grow. And it's not being unsafe. Like, I don't want students to go off and do, like, you know, get themselves in really unsafe situations, but to allow themselves to be uncomfortable. And I think that looking back on myself, not that I always did it well, right? But I think whatever it was that developed in me in terms of my personality, of pushing myself to be uncomfortable, to say, why is that not something that I'm really comfortable working with? Is that something about me? Or that's, you know, is that my own biases, prejudices that I need to address myself? So I think that that's what I did in my work at Crossover Clinic. And hopefully, you know, what I continue to do in obviously a different setting.
In 1989, you became what you describe as marginally homeless, sleeping in your car in the basement of the Junior League of Richmond's headquarters downtown, among other places. How did your views on homelessness change after your own experience with it?
I do try to make clear in the book, as well as when I do any kind of public speaking, that I was precariously housed. I wasn't literally on the streets homeless, but I was precariously housed. And what I understand from that lived experience is how chaotic just the fact of not having a safe, stable place to lay your head, to not be abused, to not have your things stolen, to be able to sleep. I mean, we know that that's a big part of mental health. So that's something that I learned straight on from the lived experience. I was speaking to a group, a church group yesterday, and one of the things I was talking about in terms of my writing, because I've written journals, my poor son has to, like, figure out what he's going to do with them when I die. And somebody asked, well, what happened? Were you still doing journal writing while you were homeless? And I said, yes, I was. But I lost those journals. It's something like a toothbrush, something essential that I carry with me. For me, that's significant in terms of I never could find that. It's disappeared somewhere, I guess, in the landfill in Richmond. So again, remembering, like, whenever I'm working with somebody who's homeless, no matter what kind of homelessness or level, which again is a problem, right? Can't really compare wounds. I remember that no matter what precipitated, you know, individually, society level for them to become homeless, just that situation of being homeless is something that contributes to ill health, including, you know, mental health issues.
You reference your journals in your work. When did you start? As a girl?
Yes, I did. I started keeping a journal. It was addressed to Dear Dragon. Dragon was my imaginary friend when I was about 10 or 11 years old. My mother, who is a professional artist here in Richmond, is very close to my mother, and she died in 2008. But before she died, she gifted me with a large manila folder full of all of my early writings, including, like, when I wasn't paying attention in church and I was writing on church bulletins. And she included some of my early journals that I didn't even know that I had. And so that, I mean, to me, because she knew that, I mean, that's my identity as a writer. And that was significant for me that she knew to keep those and then give them to me.
Let's pause for a second and have you read an excerpt, please.
Okay, what I want to read, because this is the first time I've been back in Richmond in 2 years since my father died. Mm-hmm. And catching homelessness is coming home in a way. And then also for me, again, the whole being uncomfortable and with what's going on in our society right now, with racism, and what my Southern identity means to me. So this is from chapter 2 of the book that is titled First Families. It's one of the first chapters that I wrote in response to my mother's death. It had been called Gone South. So this one is about my relationship with my mother when I was 10 years old and growing up at camp, which is a very significant two parts of the Civil War. She taught me to hunt for Civil War bullets and also arrowheads from the Pamunkey Indians. And so what I talk about is that I was absorbing the history, the significant trauma of our land from a very early age. And where I'll come in is after my mother and I was in the back seat. I was 10, coming back from the airport, the Richmond airport, to Camp Hanover, and all of a sudden she slammed on the brakes, and we were in the middle of a Ku Klux Klan meeting, full-on Ku Klux Klan meeting. And my mother was, I was absorbing her emotion, and I knew, she was shaking with anger, as well as afraid. And she and I talked about it much later, of just how afraid she was, especially as a mother, protecting me. So that's where we come in, is right at the end, after that's happened. At the dinner table that night, my father told me we had been in the middle of a Ku Klux Klan meeting. They're racist white men who wear those costumes to look like ghosts of Confederate soldiers, to scare black people, and to scare white people who don't agree with them, like it scared your mother. As I slowly chewed a mouthful of food, I considered this information. The ghostly man who had stopped us seemed polite, a Southern gentleman. Being in the midst of the KKK meeting had been exotic, dreamlike, seductive, almost beautiful. I knew that what I had seen, the way I had seen it, was not something to discuss. I swallowed the dissonance between my mother's reaction and my own experience of the encounter. The dissonance remains. It took living out of and looking back at the South to understand that ghosts becoming part of the landscape are not something to relax into. The landscape of my childhood is a landscape of half-buried violence, covered with violets, punctuated by deep, abandoned wells. The roads leading back to it are as twisted as the country roads I grew up on. Within the accretive layers of nostalgia lies the sludge of orange dust, tasting of blood. I both fear and yearn for the complexity, the offbeat rhythm of the South that has formed me.
I had underlined that passage in the book because it struck me. You're a girl, and maybe for the first time you're seeing your mother fearful. And then the other emotion is that the people she's fearing are polite. It was just such a contrast. And I can imagine that would be an impact forever. Going back to the homeless individuals that you worked with, I felt like reading your book, I got into the skin of some of the people who touched your life, like Louie and Sally and Jake and Dawn. What did they teach you about homelessness as far as sharing knowledge that helped you survive?
We never can tell someone else's story. That's like a power thing that we just shouldn't even try. But what I can tell is my own story and how it's affected by other people in my life and my relationships. That's what I was hoping to do with this book. They were real people. I mean, obviously, I changed identifying details, names, and a few places. In most of the cases, the people that I describe in the book, I got fairly close to. Like Dawn, learning what she had grown up with. Much different childhood from my own, although I had my own childhood traumas. And realizing that she was surviving the best way that she knew how. even though she was into survival sex, into prostitution, but also realizing not only the breakdowns that we have within our healthcare system, but also within society. You know, here she was, like what she'd grown up with, but then here she was in Richmond trying to survive, and agencies and people were trying to help. But then these other agencies and systems were definitely part of the problem. So that's something, especially as I was working my way out of the acute chaos of homelessness, and that's partially why I went back to graduate school to get a doctorate in health policy to try and help to change the system in at least like the small ways that I can.
What I also like about the book, toward the back, you share some ways to help the homeless. Can you share some of those with listeners?
Yes, I can. It takes a village, right? It takes a village. And this, I want to acknowledge one of my mentors, Nancy Amade, who is an amazing social justice, political advocacy, grassroots person, social worker, who actually helped to get food stamps going in our country. So I just want to acknowledge Nancy Amade. Simple ways to help the homeless. Respond with a smile and a kind word. Even it's no, sorry, when you're asked for a handout for coffee, a meal, or spare change. There's nothing worse than for a person to be ignored. And that's something, you know, again, I wasn't on the street asking for that, but that's something consistent that I hear from teenagers all the way up to older people. You can carry fast food restaurant certificates and flyers with local resources. This one's specific to Seattle. We have a poverty homelessness newspaper that's called Real Change that is really amazing. They're all over the world, but by different names, by different communities. You can buy that newspaper. That contributes to the person who is selling the newspaper as well as the newspaper itself. Becoming informed of local community solutions to homelessness and poverty. And the other thing is working upstream and supporting agencies that provide services to the homeless, but that also work on preventing homelessness, such as low-income housing or job training programs. And one that I always give to, but it's Habitat for Humanity. I mean, mm-hmm. I really think mm-hmm. that they walk the talk. And considering joining advocacy organizations such as the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, which they do amazing kind of nonpartisan work, policy work, looking at what affordable housing is available for certain localities and advocating for community-based solutions to safe, affordable housing.
You teach narrative medicine. What is that?
Narrative medicine is a very, very narrow kind of a technique that's under the umbrella of medical humanities or health humanities, which we've had forever. I mean, from the Western medicine going back to the Greeks, right? Of realizing that medicine, nursing, healthcare is not only a science, but it's an art. And it also involves humans. So bringing the humanities, bringing like what it means to be a human, to be ill, to be homeless, to be afraid, what it means to be a burned out healthcare provider. And so bringing different modalities into healthcare, into health professions education. For instance, in all of my classes, including very large classes, like 150 students, nursing students, I always incorporate low-stakes writing, reflective writing, so that they are absorbing the readings, the discussions that we're having, but making it personal for themselves of how they're like thinking through and how they'll incorporate. You know, bringing in poetry, bringing in your play when you, bringing in other ways of knowing. It can be theater, it can be, you know, dance, it can be arts, and of course, writing. Into widening the discussion about healthcare.
Let's talk about your journey as a writer. First of all, how long did it take you to write Catching Homelessness?
The germination came in 2008, after my mother's death. My mother, again, very creative person, very supportive of my writing, kept asking me when I was going to get to finally writing my book in a very maternal and gentle way, but I realized I needed to do that. I'm a mother of two children, and I work full-time, so I finally had enough time and space that I couldn't make excuses. And so I sat down to start writing it in 2008. And I had actually finished it, a solid draft with different editors weighing in, about a year and a half, now probably about 2 years ago. And I have a lot of the kind of standalone essays from the chapters that are published in literary journals, and I was thinking that was enough. And then last year I got back from teaching a community health course in New Zealand, and I just felt like it's going to get published. And so I submitted to the very last publisher that I kind of had on my list, right? You know, the whole checkoff list. And I was like, if it gets published, that's fine, whatever. And it was accepted. For me, I'm still a spiritual person, and I feel like it was the right time.
Right.
I mean, homelessness is, again, very, very huge issue in Seattle along the West Coast. And I wrote this book not only for myself, but also for my younger self, like what I wish I had known. And so one of the most gratifying ripples out of this book is that it's been adopted this year as the University of Washington Health Sciences Common Book, so that all of our students across six health science schools are encouraged to read it. In some classes, it's required reading, and we're doing discussions, but then also linking them with groups that are working on different kinds of things in terms of health and homelessness in Seattle for what they can do. The feedback that I get from some of my, especially nursing students, about what it's meant to them has made it very worthwhile.
What are some of the writing communities that help you strengthen your voice as a writer?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Here we go. Okay, so I have to, many. Again, it takes a village to, you know, raise all of us. It really takes a village. It takes a community. Seattle has a very rich, supportive writing artist community, but I have to say Hedgebrook is the one where I finished this book. It's a community supportive writers for women or people that identify gender-wise as women. Right. Gloria Steinem is on the board of directors, and it's very, very much about empowering women voices, but also real diversity of women voices. So when I was there in the fall of 2010, I was the only white person. I had people from basically all over the country, from different walks of life. And it was just this tight-knit community. We shared writing, but also we talked about racism head-on. It helped me to develop as a writer, but in many other ways as well.
What advice do you have for aspiring authors?
Just do it. Just write. I think you're either a writer or you're not, right? And there's that whole thing of when do you become an author versus a writer? I mean, there's a whole, do you have to publish a book before you're an author? But I think just do it. I mean, I tell my students, again, try not to make excuses. Finding, those times, waking up early in the morning, just to, 15 minutes. It's the discipline. It's really the discipline. That whole thing of the muse is not going to, shine on you unless you're there. Or even finding times like a bathroom break at work to write a little haiku. I mean, just do it, because it's like anything else, like rowing or like sports. It takes those miles of writing to improve.
What's next for you? Do you have another writing project, another book in mind?
I do. I have a second manuscript that is completed. I had a 9-month sabbatical from my work last year, which is a great gift. And I finished my second manuscript, which is going more deeply into trauma-informed care, both for individuals and for communities. Its working title right now is called Soul Stories.
Great title.
Yes, thank you. So it's under review by a few academic presses.
Oh.
Yeah, it's more experimental. It's probably more literary because with trauma, you don't have a straight narrative.
Okay.
So I try to like break the narrative and include poetry. I had a lot of fun with it, but we'll see.
Okay. Josephine, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to see you and talk with you again.
Thank you for sharing your writings and your wisdom with Virginia Voice.